Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast, the home for conversations with global leaders in the trade show and events business. Our show will bring you face to face with experts who speak about the possibilities and trajectories of this $50 billion industry. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make conversion easy. Welcome to this episode of the Trade Show Podcast. Thank you for listening and your continued feedback. If you have suggestions or you want me to dig in with a specific guest, please write to me at shubhanjan@pitch.link or message me on LinkedIn. Both links available in the show notes. My guest today, Miguel Nevis, is the editor at Skift Meetings, and we speak on a wide range of topics, including the evolution of event media, impact of AI, the latest state of the industry report from JWC, and what an 11-star event experience for attendees could look like.
I am now paid to be skeptical, to be impartial, to almost kind of break apart what I was trying to do before, right? Because when you work in marketing, you try to put some fancy words and some concepts and explain things in a way that helps sales. And now I'm sort of, part of my job is to look at what's out there, what people are saying, and take it apart and get down to basics and really try to give our readers a very balanced view of the industry, what's going on.
Miguel leads the editorial team at Skift Meetings, where he and his team passionately tell the incredible stories around the business of events. He has worked in and around events for almost 20 years in various roles, covering planning, marketing, social media, and editorial. Miguel has been at the forefront of innovation in event technology and AI for more than 15 years and has closely followed the rapid evolution and impact of AI. He is a Portuguese soul who built a career in the UK and is now raising a young family in southern Denmark. His favorite place in the world is a Portuguese beach on a sunny summer day. Now, on to this insightful episode with Miguel Nevis. Miguel, welcome to the Trade Show Podcast. I'm delighted that you could make time early in the morning and talk to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Subjahan. Looking forward to it.
You shifted from marketing to being the editorial director at Skift. How are you finding the transition from storytelling in some form to a different form of storytelling?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for asking. So I've been with Skift Meetings for 5 years now. So I'm editor-in-chief of Skift Meetings. I have an editorial director on Skift, which is, you know, my boss as well. So that's kind of a different level. But it's been interesting. You know, my career has been all within events. So I see myself as an events person, you know, business events, essentially. After I was working at IMEX, the exhibition, the trade show for the industry, for 6 years. And then I left and started my own kind of marketing company, you know, went on my own. And that was, you know, very focused. I was working with some associations and then some event tech and some smaller agencies as well. So those were sort of my main clients. So it was, yeah, like you say, it was always about storytelling. It was always, I guess, with a very direct focus either on sort of generating sales, you know, that sort of marketing side, or from the association perspective, generating revenue from registrations and that sort of thing. And then I got this opportunity to take over from the founder of EventMB, Julius Solaris. That was an acquisition that Skift made, and then, you know, became editor-in-chief of what is now Skift Meetings. Super interesting in the sense that I am now paid to be skeptical, to be impartial, to almost kind of break apart what I was trying to do before, right? Because when you work in marketing, you try to put some fancy words and some concepts and explain things in a way that helps sales. And now I'm sort of, part of my job is to look at what's out there, what people are saying, and take it apart and get down to basics and really try to give our readers a very balanced view of the industry, what's going on. So I feel very privileged in the sense that I'm paid to research, I'm paid to look at stories, to look at the industry and try to extract the best stories at the end of the day. There's still stories, you know, there's still editorial choices made all the time, but we're really trying to be very factual, very balanced in our reporting. And And that's interesting and rare, right? I think media is going through a really interesting time. And so I think it's quite rare for a publication to really want to do that. So I feel quite privileged that I'm in that position.
Very interesting. I mean, my background also is media, but we'll not get into that now. I have a question. See, the first internet wave, which is the .com and post.com, newspapers and magazines and media per se realize that they have to be there, right? And that sort of led to a bunch of internet native products and platforms. And there are quite a few in the exhibition space also. There are many who were very active in the internet and website and digital media space. I had the good fortune when I launched the web the podcast. David Duwa was one of my guests. My question to you is, given that internet has been around and digital media consumption and publication is sort of now normalized, where do you think this is headed? And how can reporting and writing and exchanging about the trade show and events industry be more effective or can be sort of enhanced?
Well, if I knew the answer to that question, I would I'd probably not be here, right? I'd be building the company that does that. I think it's a good question. Obviously, everybody wants to know that, wants to understand. Like, I spent many years at IMEX trying to create or trying to demonstrate the buzz of the show floor online, right? Mm. When you're at a big trade show, there's this kind of noise, there's people talking, there's all sorts of happening, and there's a lot of energy, right? You feel this energy of being in these places. And I was always trying to kind of recreate that online or give people a taste of that. Mm. And ultimately, I sort of had to stop myself somehow because it's not the same. And it's very, you know, I think the online experience is quite different, right? And I think trying to sort of replicate that in some way is probably not the right approach. But what I think happens at trade shows and conferences and business events is that there are really interesting conversations. There's really interesting content being shared. There's sort of new ideas being sparked. And so I think the most important reporting that we can do is to try to get that, those core elements to people digitally, to people online. And that can take many different formats. You know, that can take live video from the show floor, kind of reporting what's happening. But I think ultimately it's about repackaging that information, repackaging the content, finding ways to transmit that online in useful ways. Because I think sort of reporting live video from the buzzy trade show floor is not that interesting. You know, it's kind of interesting for a few trade show geeks and people that really get excited about that stuff. But from a, you know, from a sort of vertical perspective, from somebody operating within that vertical of that trade show, how noisy the trade show floor is irrelevant, right? What's interesting is what deals are being made, what's being said on stage, what new ideas are coming through. And so I think the secret to that is quickly turning those into useful pieces of content online, you know, and I think it's quickly because you want to do it while a lot of people's attention is on that trade show, is on that happening. But you also want to create it in a format that makes sense. You know, and if we take TikTok or Instagram Reels as the, you know, maybe not as business to business friendly media, but that's sort of like where we are in terms of social media. If you can take a really interesting keynote or a really interesting announcement and make an engaging short video from it within an hour or two, then I think you're winning, right? Then I think you're creating content that's relevant for the audience in a format that works within that format. And I think the other point to sort of your question is the distribution question. which is we can create all this content, but if it's not ending up in a place where people are used to consuming that content, then it also gets a bit lost. Like, it doesn't have an impact. You know, I think a lot of people have this idea where they have relatively standard media on their social channels, you know, news, mm-hmm. links, that kind of thing. And then there's a big event and suddenly they put out loads of video and they do lots of kind of like, oh, this is going to be great. But if the people that are following that channel aren't used to that format, then it may not really have an impact. And so it's also important that that content ends up in, you know, in front of the right people in a way that they're sort of used to consuming it. So it's a multi-layered kind of answer. I hope I'm giving you some insight into what I think works, but it's hard to do, I think, especially in the B2B world, because we take the example from the B2C world a lot of times, from the direct-to-consumer, and I think it works, but ultimately, I think we have to remember that we're in a B2B world that's not that exciting to the average person, and so I think keeping that in context is also important.
True, and also, I think there are two types of content that will get consumed, right? One is people who are already in the show floor. They would consume a certain kind of content because they want to make their presence there more effective. But their consumption will be very low because they're there physically not to consume something digitally, but to actually interact, actually shake hands and have coffee and have a drink and so on and so forth. So that's, but yet they have some needs. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is outside and a lot of it is post event consumption is also what I imagine.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. And yeah, going back to my IMAX stage, which is now, you know, 10 years ago, but I think still relevant, we did a lot of analysis of when content really worked. And for the people that were on site, it was really important to get great content to them early in the morning. Mm. You know, sort of the summary of the day before, something that happened. Because that's, you know, when people are getting dressed, people are getting ready, they're catching up with news, that's when they're scrolling. And that's when they're going to respond. And they're sort of like, I guess in a way, there's more eyes on your content at that moment, right? There's a moment where there's a lot of people that are, the content is relevant to them because they're at the show, but they're not busy on the show floor, right? So that's right. Sort of like, you know, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. period, even though nothing's happening, is super important for distribution because that's when you want people to be able to consume it.
That's so valuable. Yeah, wonderful. We'll shift gear. Have you had a chance to look at the GIPR report from JWC?
I just hit publish on a story about their segmented rankings. So right. They won't give access to the full report to media, which is a little unusual, but they're very protective of their reports. They're 900 page reports. But I interviewed both Kai Hattendorf and Jochen Witt a few days ago about the segmented rankings, which are super interesting.
Right. I mean, in fact, I'm having a conversation with Kai right after we finish our conversation. So I'm hoping to get something out of him. So what is your observation? I mean, obviously, it makes sense if you're doing a multidimensional kind of framework. It gives you possibly better insights. Any additional take from you?
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting that they've kind of said this is the first time that they're going this deep into different country data, right? Yeah. And I think what they're trying to do is question some of the assumptions and you know, kind of dissect the data in different ways. I'm a little bit torn because in some ways what the results show is relatively obvious. You know, you have this overall ranking, which is sort of like, what are the countries that are doing best in terms of exhibitions? And the surprising thing there is that France is above Germany, right? That's really interesting because Germany is seen as this like old school country with these very big convention centers, and they have all these fairs that are created by the convention center, you know, very traditional model that works in sort of the German industrialization, you know, for the last century almost, right? But that model is very static, and it feels like it's really not dynamic enough for the markets today. a lot of shows are going to China, a lot of things are leaving, and there's a lot of big exhibition centers in Germany without much happening, right? They're only busy, I don't know, half of the year. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that there's a lot of kind of empty space. And France, and I think also like the Netherlands and the UK and other markets are much more dynamic. They don't have as big venues, but they're moving things around. They're, you know, they're kind of refurbishing and remodeling venues to really make it as efficient as possible, you know, and so it makes a lot of sense. And I think because they're not, a lot of the companies operating in these countries aren't government owned, you know, they're just like, well, we're going to move over there. Or we're going to do something else. They'll just move with the market. So it's much more flexible. And I, in the article, I actually give the example of Espo, I think it's called, the show that Raccoon Media and Messe München are actually moving to Amsterdam because it doesn't work in Munich. And it's a show that's been in Munich for many years, right? So it's a bit of a very unusual example, at least, you know, from traditional. But India is also, I think, in eighth place, which I think is super interesting, right? And, you know, and that's one I definitely dissected. I'm like very happy for India. I think it's a great positioning, but I think it's pretty well known that India's infrastructure isn't quite at the level of other countries, right? There's, especially for a country the size of India, the most populous country in the world, there is a huge amount of potential, right? There's just a huge market potential. And then India makes it to number one spot in the market attractivity ranking, you know, the segmented ranking. And that's where, you know, in some ways it's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, you have this very, very large market that's not as focused on exhibitions as it could be, right? And so you will probably be much better informed than I am to explain why maybe India isn't quite as advanced in exhibitions as it could be, the potential, etc. But there's an obvious, you know, huge market potential, not as many exhibitions there as possible. So it's interesting to see it in data in black and white, but it's, you know, relatively obvious. And then you have Brazil and Turkey also making that top 10. Again, you know, BRIC countries, very, you know, big economies. I guess Turkey is not a BRIC country, but also, you know, a very dynamic, you know, and large economy with a lot of potential. You know, and then you have these two other rankings, the business ecosystem quality ranking sort of seems to reward you know, connectivity, hotels, infrastructure, that kind of thing that sort of is needed for a successful trade show. Singapore tops the ranking. You know, we know Singapore is a very efficient country, has a great market, etc., but is relatively small, right? So it's an interesting ranking, but it doesn't mean like, okay, we're all going to go invest in Singapore now because they have great infrastructure. There's probably not, you know, enough there. And then the final ranking, competitive opportunity, again, interesting. But a little bit, I don't know how much to read into this, right? You have China top, which for me says, okay, there's still a lot of opportunity in China. But then you know, you have this Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman in the top 10. You know, Middle East economies. Unfortunately, there's a lot of, you know, conflict happening in the Middle East. So while we're reporting this, so I think it's important to acknowledge that. Hopefully it gets resolved and, you know, as peaceful as possible. But I think the message there is these countries have invested a lot in infrastructure. You know, they have big convention centers, modern convention centers, which is different to the German example. And they're keen to have people come and do shows there, right? So they're very open to people coming and doing business. Now, I think if you kind of contrast that with then the other rankings, the market attractivity ranking, for example, I think it's sort of almost the opposite, right? You have these countries with large venues, well-equipped, ready to do business, but a lot of these countries, you know, don't have a big market. And so, you know, if you're going to invest in a trade show there and there isn't a local market to really support that, it's a very tough proposition, right? Are you really going to get all the big buyers, global buyers to these markets? You know, I can see, you know, the Middle East traditionally very, you know, energy, oil kind of markets. I can see those shows doing well. But outside of those traditionally strong industries in the Middle East, I think it's tough. So, you know, to summarize, very interesting to see this in black and white. I like seeing data. I like seeing rankings. But part of me also says, this is relatively obvious stuff. It's a question of like, how do you interpret it and what do you use to make your business decisions?
Yeah, makes sense. And this framework has to mature. according to me.
Mm-hmm.
It has to mature. I think it puts some foundation of how you may want to do it. And I'll not be surprised if some of it changes next year.
I would actually counter that in the sense that I'd like to see it not change. Because I think what would be very valuable is if they do it again next year and you see shifts.
Yeah, of course.
Because the danger is you change the criteria, right? And then the ranking shifts. Yeah. But then it sends a bit of a wrong message, right? Because then it's like, well, you changed the criteria, so therefore the ranking shift. So I'd like to see it. You know, obviously there's things that they might say, okay, this wasn't quite right. But I think the trends over the next few years would be really interesting.
Yeah, true. I agree. I'll refer to two articles that you wrote, and then we'll move to our 11-star event experience question. One is about AI and event tech. Mm-hmm. And I have a very simple, blunt question to you. How much of this is hype? And how much of this is real?
And you want me to focus specifically on event tech, I would imagine, right?
Because I'm happy to talk about the rest because the question will remain the same.
Yes, true. Look, I'm quite skeptical about AI. I think there's no doubt it's a very powerful technology, right? And so I think I've done some research on AI, and we've actually done some workshops on AI. And most of the time when we talk about AI, we're talking about ChatGPT, right? We're talking about the large language models. We're talking about that AI, like the chatbot large language model AI. And do you know what the T in ChatGPT stands for?
No, I don't.
So it stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer.
Okay.
Generative, it creates things. Pre-trained, it's trained on these large amount of data from the internet. Transformer. And for me, the most interesting thing is the T, the transformer. And it's a reminder to us that these are pieces of software that we don't actually know how they work. They're so complex and they're working and they have so much data that they're trained on. But the reminder is that they're transformers. So what that means is you give them an instruction, and the more complex the instruction is, the better, because it sort of like limits what it can do or gives it more idea. But it then outputs an answer. It's not a verification engine. It's not a fact checker. Like anytime a editor or writer tells me that they fact check something using ChatGPT, that's cause for disciplinary action.
Yes.
That's not what these things are used for. Now, I know Perplexity and, you know, ChatGPT can use the internet, so it's a little bit blended. But if you're using a pure large language model, they're not meant to fact check. They're not meant to, you know, they're really terrible at math. If you give them a math problem, they usually give you the wrong answer. Because they're transformers, they're sort of trained to give you the answer that they think you're looking for. And so, sorry for going on a bit of a loop, but why I think this is important is when you think about then applying that to event technology, I think there's some stuff that it's very good at. There's some things that it can be very good at. So for example, for marketing, for sending emails, for creating the text for the website, for really all the promotional written content, and also image creation and video and those kind of things, great. You know, if used with taste, carefully, and always with a human editor, I think it can really be a game changer because you can do things way faster. It's also really good at crunching data, you know, within the right security features, et cetera. If you give it survey questions, if you give it input from, you know, registration tables, those kind of things, it can make predictions. It can say, look, based on this data, it looks like you're going here, or this is what everybody said, and therefore you have to do that. So within that, I think there's a lot of stuff already that can really move faster. And then, you know, moving around Excel spreadsheets, anything like that, AI can really help to kind of do that. But that's not everything that we do as event organizers, right? And so I think that's where it's really important to keep things into context. There are other things like content transcription and summarization. AI is quite good at that. So that's a sort of proven use case. There's the facial recognition. You know, I don't know if you've used those tools that recognize your face and then show you any photos that were taken mm-hmm. with you in them. So that's really good for sort of post-event engagement, because a lot of times you see this album of photos from the event, you're always looking for the photos of yourself, right? And with AI, true. It gives you those right away, right? So that's super powerful. So there are these really proven use cases. And now I think more and more there's sort of sourcing use cases where AI can help. And this is more on the kind of conference side and event side, but AI can help you find the right destination and the right venue. And I think that part is really interesting. A little bit, I'm not completely convinced that it always works or it always gives you the right answer, but I think a lot of the searching for the right destination, the right venue takes a long time, and a lot of it is rather unstructured, right? True. And so that's where AI can really come in and give you some ideas. It won't replace somebody who's really knowledgeable, right? Somebody who mm-hmm. knows what the load-in dock looks like and why that venue works and that one doesn't, right? Because that stuff, I mean, it will if that stuff is online, but that's usually kept proprietary, right? People that know right. keep that to themselves. So the AI has no way of knowing that, right? So is it a game changer or not? Is it all hype? I don't think it's all hype, but I don't think it solves everything. And the danger is that you have companies that will probably get rid of their staff and become, you know, 50% of what they used to be because AI can do it all for them. And the challenge is that a lot of what AI does is wrong, right? Because again, it's a transformer. So it'll give you the answer that you think you want, and it'll make it look good enough so that you look at it and say, oh yeah, this is great. But then somebody who really knows what they're talking about looks at it and goes, this is garbage. This is just AI slop, right? And so that's the bit that I'm not sure. I think the best companies and the best processes will find ways to use the power, but bring it back into a kind of human in the loop system where you can always improve and do better. But that needs to be really well thought out. That's not something that you can just sort of automatically get AI to do. You need to create the systems. You need to make it work with you. And so I think there is a sort of, I wouldn't say exponential, but there is a definite increase in efficiency and some things that are just impossible to do without AI. But most situations, it's a sort of incremental efficiency in making, you know, in getting to the thing that you want to a lot quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are many, many points there, but we'll possibly not delve into that. I think we experimented once of getting rid of people when the pandemic happened. And we have paid a very heavy price as industry in trying to get back. Although I know the numbers are very good and we are back on our 2019 numbers and so on and so forth, which is part of the GIPR report as well. But I'm saying that making haste to get rid of people may not be a very good idea.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
I think what's happening with a lot of companies is that they're pinning it on AI, but what's really happening is they're struggling. Right. And then they're kind of going, oh, we'll just use AI instead. And the stock market loves that. You know, you have these companies, what is it? Block just announced they're going to fire 40% of their staff, I think it is. And the stock market rose like 20% or something like that. Just, you know, it's just horrible to think that people profiting from people getting fired is something that makes the markets, you know, ignite. But I think that's short-sighted.
You are listening to a Bizcast Audio Original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for the Trade Show podcast and founder of PitchLink, the visitor engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode. Making haste to get rid of people may not be a very
good idea, very, very basic level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bad idea all around AI, right? But it's...
I think
what's happening with a lot of companies is that they're pinning it on AI, but what's really happening is they're struggling, right? And then they're kind of going, oh, we'll just use AI instead. And the stock market loves that. You know, you have these companies, what is it, Block just announced they're going to fire 40% of their staff, I think it is.
And
the stock market rose like 20% or something like that. Just, you know, it's just horrible to think that people profiting from people getting fired is something that makes the markets, you know, ignite. But I think that's short-sighted. And I think ultimately that will be a downfall. And look, in a sort of utopian world, we all don't need jobs and AI will do all the work for us. But I don't, you know, I'm not here to defend everybody's jobs. I think some jobs are not great jobs. And if AI can do them for us, then I think it's fantastic. And I'm very much a realist when it comes to that. But ultimately, I think we need to also prioritize people and you know, find good ways to use people.
Yeah, I guess that's what leadership is about, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's, yeah, the leaders that are going to prevail are the ones that are going to, you know, find a way forward, right, without just getting rid of people. Who are you going to lead? Are you going to just lead the AIs?
Yeah, and you said something very, very critical, I think, and we may miss that most of the companies who are in haste to do this are really not doing very well. So it is sort of their sort of clinching at, okay, this will help us move the stock market number a bit and let's just go and do it. And anyway, it's 1,000 people, who cares?
Yeah, anyway. Dangerous times.
Dangerous times, yeah. In more ways than one. The second article is about Jordan Lacey, and you profiled her, and I said, as admittedly, I have not read through the entire article, talking about Gen Z coming into leadership positions. And I was mentioning to you that I had a very interesting chat on this podcast with Dr. Corey Simler, who is a global expert on Gen Z. So what's your take on Gen Z with reference to this article on Jordan?
Yeah, Jordan is one of our SCIF Meetings Advisory Council members, and she's a young, very talented planner, and she's been on stage quite a bit as sort of the Gen Z planner, right? So I think she takes a lot of credit there, and credit due to her, absolutely. I think the Gen Z conversation is super interesting because we're actually preparing quite a lengthy report on that, which will be out in mid-April. But my feeling on Gen Z is that they get scapegoated a lot. And I think a lot of what I see about Gen Z comes from people from other generations. And I think there's a lot of stereotyping and sort of assumptions of what Gen Z wants and you know, how they act different and how they're digital natives and how they're, I don't know, maybe even AI natives at this point, you know, like all these different things. But for me, what it really comes down to is designing events or designing experiences that work for everybody. For me, it's more about universal design than figuring out what Gen Z wants, right? Because, okay, if you're running an event that's just for very young people, Gen Z, okay, fine. Then absolutely focus on what Gen Z wants and do that. But for most of us, we're running events with multi-generations. Right.
Yeah.
And we have teams with multiple generations on them. Right. And so I think it's really important to do things in a really holistic way. One of the things that comes out a lot is that Gen Z won't do overtime, or they won't work hard, or they won't do all these things, or they won't stand for boring events. They'll revolt. And then I think, you know what? I think most people don't want boring events. Right. They want exciting events. They want stuff happening. They've just been conditioned and they've gone to so many events that are just boring that they sort of think that that's normal. So, you know, rather than punish Gen Z because they're revolting at, you know, these events, I think it's great if they turn around and say, like, I'm not going to come to this event. This sounds really boring. Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that other generations should probably also do the same, or at least acknowledge that they also don't want to sit in a dark room for 6 hours and be talked at. You know, that's not somebody's idea of a good time. I know that, you know, in medical meetings, people can get really excited about things happening on stage, and they will happily sit for 6 hours in a dark room. But in general, that's just a bad way to communicate. You know, there are better ways of communicating and engaging people than doing that to people. And so I always go back to, hey, why don't we design things that are fun, but informative, but engaging, and but, you know, you connect everyone. And I'm pretty sure we can do that in a way that older generations and younger generations can really get the most out of it, right? So absolutely, I think it's very important to be aware of different generational stereotypes, but I think a lot of times they're just stereotypes. I don't know if you've ever heard of David Allison, maybe somebody to have on your podcast. He created a thing called value graphics. He basically says that all the generational stereotypes are just, they don't work. And that people within the same generation only have about, I think he says something like 10 or 20% of the same values. And so when you're sort of saying what somebody values depends on their age, you know, even as I say that, it's like, yeah, maybe the age isn't the only thing that decides what people care about, right? And I think that's the danger when you get stuck in this generational conversation, that you kind of make age the only definition of, you know, the only way to split people up or to kind of think about the way people work. So I think there's absolutely other ways to think about that. And I'm a big fan of event design and experience design. So whatever we can do to make those experiences better, I think should benefit everybody.
Absolutely. This is great. And that gives us a nice segue to go into our next idea that we wanted to talk about. Yep. So when I wrote to you, Miguel, you remember that I was referring to this Brian Chesky interview, which he had given to Reid Hoffman many years back when they started the Masters of Scale podcast. And he's talking about this whole thought experiment that they did at Airbnb about what is a 1-star experience and what could be potentially a 11-star experience, right?
Yeah.
And that sort of came back to me for some reasons, and I thought that it would be interesting to do this thought experiment with thought leaders like you who are basically invested in the industry and thinking about it, and actually imagine what's a 1-star event and what's a 11-star event for the attendee. Of course, I mean, there are two parts, right? One is the attendee and the exhibitor, but today let's focus on the attendee and imagine what, according to you, would be a 1-star, and then 2, 3, 4, whatever numbers you want to take.
Yeah, I think, and you want to go particularly for exhibitions, right? So the exhibition experience.
And trade shows, yes. Where attendees are coming to engage with exhibitors as well as, not conferences, if that's your question.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
If you feel free to talk about it, but I think my core thought was about trade shows.
I think if we think of the 1-star as sort of the worst possible experience, I think it starts from discovery, you know, finding about the event. Some events are really hard to find out about. Booking, registration, booking, you know, long registration sites, not mobile friendly, difficult payments, finding out information about how to book your hotel, you know, all these kind of things are very important and sometimes overlooked, like easily overlooked. You know, so making that, you know, finding out about the trade show, the exhibition, understanding who's going to be there, making sure there's that business case, booking, doing all those things, then finding out how to book meetings with the people that are coming. You know, some shows are, you know, appointment based, some are not, but, you know, whatever is the best way to connect people. You know, and depending on different data regulations and how it all works, can you search whatever, you know, there's lots of different variations of that, but making it so that it's easy to do, even with whatever restrictions, I think is super important. You know, and that's, I guess, if you want to do the 1-star and 11-star version, you know, 1-star is obviously none of that works. And, you know, I don't know, they have to pick up a phone to register. I don't know, like, I don't know how bad the experience can be. But I know that some, judging from websites and judging from people's experiences, a lot of them are, you know, in places they don't necessarily want to go to. You get charged a lot for your hotel. You get charged a lot for food because you're in a place that, you know, you can't really get anywhere else. So, you know, it's tough. The 11-star would be, you know, a great website that works well, easy to understand what the event's about, where people are going to be, how people are going to flow around. Booking is easy. So I think, you know, from the sort of pre-event, I think that's the 11-star. You know, if you really want to go extreme for the 11-star, I guess a concierge kind of service. I think a lot of websites, going back to the AI question, are adding an AI chatbot that is supposed to help you do all this. My personal experience is a lot of times I don't want the chatbot. I actually prefer a well-designed website where I can search for myself. Because sometimes some websites are like not very easy to find information, but then they have an AI chatbot that's supposed to sort of tell you what you need. And when it works, it's actually pretty cool. But when it doesn't, I sort of want to have that safety of being able to find it myself, right? Or being able to just look through an agenda or a floor show, show floor map, that kind of thing. I know that there's a few companies that are really investing in creating a whole AI kind of concierge system. So I guess the 11-star version of the AI chatbot, where you say, hey, the reason why I want to come to this show is to do this and do that. And then in a few minutes, you get a message back with some people that you should meet, exhibitors that you should meet, and, you know, sort of make it very easy for you. It all sounds great in theory. I've not seen it in practice yet. And I don't want to be negative and say that that'll never work, but I haven't seen it perfect yet. And I've spoken to a lot of companies about this, and part of it is the data regulation. So it's actually quite hard to do this and keep, like, you know, the data safe and make sure you're not kind of doing anything that people won't feel comfortable with, especially on the buyer supplier side, right? I don't think buyers necessarily want to give away too much information. So that makes it harder. So the technology can do this all. It just needs really good data, really good up-to-date data. And then usually the fallback is, oh, our AI can scrape people's LinkedIn profiles and it can find all this information, which is great if everybody had really up-to-date LinkedIn profiles with all, you know, like, I mean, like, if you're just scraping garbage, then the recommendations will still be garbage.
Right. Tell me, I mean, once you're inside the show, I mean, imagine that this worked out pretty well. Mm-hmm. What will make a significant difference to the experience when you are in the show?
I think the arrival is really important. So even before you're actually on the show floor, like finding, like even just finding the right door to go into sometimes is really hard. Like some exhibition centers make that really hard. You know, they're usually very large. And then it's like, oh, I'm in hall 8. Great. But hall 8 has 24 access points. And some of which there's a security guard going, no, you can't come this way. And in some of which there's a grand entrance, right? But knowing exactly which one to use is super important. So I think little things like that. And I guess really giving people, especially first timers, you know, and I think we forget, like in most shows, there are like almost 50%, somewhere between like 30 to 50% first timers, right? And a lot of shows are sort of like, oh yeah, we do this every year. It's always the same place. Great. But if I've never come, that doesn't mean anything to me. So having a really strong visualization of where things are before you even walk in, I think it's very important. And that could even just be a diagram, right? Like this is what the hall looks like. Some sort of simple color coding, like, you know, if you're in a machining exhibition, I don't know, manual machines are in the blue area, electronic machines are in the green area, whatever it is, you know, just something simple where you're like, okay, I know where I want to go, right? I think that's super important. And once you get in, I think the flow of people, the way everything is, the place, you know, where the booths are, where the paths are, everything, really should be carefully thought of. And, you know, in some halls, it's easier. You have more openness. Other halls, you know, there's a design already of the hall that you can't really change. You know, there's a sort of, there's an entrance here and you have to go through there. But making that first moment as least stressful as possible, I think is really important, even for people that have been there 100 times, right? Like, I'll give you a random example. When I was at, this was actually after I stopped working for IMAX, but I went back to the IMAX show in Las Vegas. And at one, for 1 year, they had some, they had like a hosted buyer lounge in the hall below the main hall. So I went down and I was doing some filming or something there. And then I came back up and I walked up the escalator and I completely lost track of direction. The hall was so full and there were so many things in every direction that I was like, I know I'm in the middle of the show floor somewhere, but I don't know in which direction the entrance is. Like, I didn't know which direction was what, right? And it took me a few minutes to like just understand where I was again. And obviously that's, you know, very kind of just fun, like random example, but exhibition centers are really confusing. You know, they're really large and booths, a lot of them look very similar, right? Like it's not that easy. So making that experience as human as possible, I think is really good. And I go back to the simple color coding. You know, if you can make one hall or one part of the hall one color, another part of the hall, even if it's just the carpet or something like that, I think that really helps just to get like that immediate thing. I think some people are a fan of the kind of human concierge, that idea of having people really help you find what you need. I'm a little bit skeptical on that in terms of the scalability, particularly in a trade show environment. You know, I think it's great. You can help a few hundred people, you know, per hour or whatever it is. But I think a lot of it has to be very obvious and very design focused. You know, like you just need to kind of be like immediately kind of figure it out yourself. But yeah, I think that like treating people as human and helping them really understand where they are and what they can do in that space. I mean, the amount of times I'm at a trade show and I tell people about, I don't know, maybe an education stage, and they're like, oh, I didn't know there was education here. You know, I didn't know there was a stage. Like they never found it, right? They never found, and I'm sure I'm the same, right? I go to shows and I, you know, there's things that I didn't even know were there. And it's not an easy thing to fix, right? Because depending on the size of the show, it gets to a point where it's impossible for you to know everything. So it's about giving people information in a way that they can really find. And that's, to me, where I think this whole AI chatbot concierge thing doesn't necessarily solve this. Because, it, you know, if you don't know something exists, then how are you going to ask the AI about it?
Right? Absolutely.
And so Absolutely. It's, you know, there's more of a design, a communication design issue there than a AI can solve this issue.
Absolutely. And what would you say exhibitors can do? So a lot of what you said just now are for organizers to make the attendees experience stellar. But when you think of exhibitors who are putting up booths, who are actually, they're really literally the fountain of the entire financial backbone of the industry, right? If exhibitors don't come and pay, it's not going to happen. So what do you think exhibitors are doing wrong, and what do you think they can do better? I know it's a generic question. Be as specific as you feel.
Yeah. Look, I'll give you an example from event technology, you know, an area that I've focused a lot on. Event technology is quite tricky to, like, to create a booth that makes it easy for you to understand what an event technology company does is quite tricky, because really the software itself is usually not that pretty, right? You know, like registration software is, you know, like an enhanced spreadsheet. Like it's not that exciting, right? And so putting a bunch of screenshots of your software probably won't solve it, right? But I remember Hopin, I don't know if you're familiar with Hopin,
etc. Yes, yes, of course.
Crazy unicorn during the pandemic, you know, what was it? $7.5 billion evaluation, something like that, right? As much as everybody wants to hate Hopin, they did a few things really well, right? And one of the things that I remember they did really well was they would go to trade shows before the pandemic, you know, when they were just a virtual event platform that was, you know, a sort of a minor blip in the exhibition space or the event tech space. I can't remember the exact message, but they had a very, very clear kind of tagline. Right? Mm-hmm. And it was, I can't remember the exact message, but there's a photo of them. I think Dave Schools, their CMO, shared a photo of them sort of at one of their first trade shows. And they had this like pop-up banner that I think had a message with like four words. It was like any event, anytime, online, something like that, right? And for me, that was like, that's smart, right? Because you go to trade shows where there's event tech companies exhibiting, and it's usually quite hard to understand what they do. And I do this a lot. I go to a lot of trade shows that have, you know, event tech areas or dedicated event tech shows. And if I actually engage with every exhibitor, I couldn't. There's just not enough time in the day, right? There's just too many, right? So I sort of look from a bit of a distance and I try to figure out, okay, what do these guys do? Do I know them? Do I not know them? If I don't know, you know, I kind of want to figure out what they do pretty quickly. And it's usually really hard, you know? And you could argue, yeah, great. That makes people go and speak to the rep. I would argue, no, that's bad design, right? Yeah, I want people to come and speak to the rep when they go, oh, you do that? Cool. Tell me, right? Not what do you do? Like if somebody comes up to your booth and asks you, what do? You've lost, right? Because the chance that they actually are the right fit for your company, it's a crapshoot, right? It's 1 in 10, 1 in 100. I don't know, right? Like it doesn't really matter, right? And so I think from a basic sort of, you know, thinking from a journalistic perspective, the companies that exhibit need to get their headline right. They need to get their headline and they need to get their image right, their imagery right. You know, and I don't think a lot of them do. I think a lot of them use complicated acronyms. They use industry terms. They use things that don't necessarily mean anything to anyone. So it goes back to design for me. If you can make it very clear what you do, I think if you can make a booth, a stand that is open, that attracts people by the openness, you know, then you can giveaways, you can play games, you can have screens, you can have whatever you do. But if it's not open, then people don't feel welcome, right? So I think that's super important. And then the other side is really doing the homework, because many companies go to trade shows and sort of depend on walk-in traffic, or they go the opposite way and they really spam the heck out of everybody at the show. And that's not good either, right? What you want to do is, I always think of trade shows as incredible moments, opportunities, because they're a moment in time when an entire industry is focused on one location, right? And so I think it's about maximizing that. So if you do your research, you figure out who's going to be there or who you think's going to be there, and you make sure they know that you're there and they know what you do, then the magic happens, right? But that takes work. That takes a lot of research, and it's not just showing up and having a loud booth with a big neon sign and a big arrow. Like, right? Yeah. But if that's not your target market, it doesn't really help you do business.
I want to mention that over the period of this podcast, what I've learned is organizers sort of protect the attendee data as gold, right? Because that's their mainstay. That's what they're dangling in front of the exhibitor to bring them in. Mm-hmm. Yet they're not doing enough to help the exhibitor do pre-engagement and some kind of... I completely agree. It's not about spamming everybody who has registered. I mean, I have got 50,000 registrations. Doesn't mean every exhibitor spams everybody. I mean, that will be like a mess. But doing something, and I don't know what. I'm not trying to suggest a way. But I'm saying doing something that exhibitor X actually has a fit with these 500 people out of the 50,000. That's all you really need to talk to.
Yeah.
And facilitate that in some form. I think becomes very critical because that's really why people, what we see is increasingly, you know, I just want to mention, a friend of mine runs a tech company out of the Valley, and they're in a specialized area, Kanban, project management kind of space. Mm-hmm. And they went to a very large show. I know that they spent about $100,000 sponsoring and so on and so forth. Anyway, and end of it, they had 1,500, what they called end of the show leads. Mm-hmm. Okay. And after 1 year, they were talking to exactly one person.
Wow.
Maybe it's exaggerated, but what I'm telling is true, but this is not made up. And that I'm willing to understand that that's not the case with everybody. They may be talking to three people or four, but the more I talk to people and wherever people are willing to give you data and tell you openly, that's really what's happening, because there is a whole conflict between getting walk-ins or getting traffic to your booth to having buyers to your booth. I mean, these are two different things.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of layers there. One is data privacy, right? I think, you know, in the like 90s, 2000s, especially in the States where the data laws are very lax, you know, you would sign up for something and your email would end up on 100 different mailing lists right away, right? Like the data was shared very freely. And then there was a lot of backlash there, right? So talking about sort of technology solutions, I think it only works if the people registering understand what's going to happen with their data, right? So I think that's one thing that I don't see a lot of shows doing it well, right? If they can explain, look, with your permission, we're going to do this, and we're going to look through everybody's, you know, profile and figure out, depending on your choices, then we'll find, you know, people that you should meet. If that's all well explained and people provide enough data, then there's no reason why we can't do that efficiently. You know, I think the other side to that, there's many other sides to that, but one thing is, I don't know your friend's company, obviously, but it could be that it wasn't the right show for them, right? Or, you know, there are situations where people go and exhibit and the salesperson of the exhibition will say, yeah, this is definitely the right place for you, but actually the people that they're trying to meet aren't there. So, you know, that's more of a sales versus reality angle. But I think that the most important thing is, with AI and with scraping and all this technology out there, if you're going to a trade show to get a leads list, then it's a waste of money, right? Because you can do that online for almost no money, right? It doesn't mean that those people will reply to your emails when you email them, but you can find their email addresses pretty easily these days, right? And so I think that the more important way of thinking about it is, I see trade shows as much more sort of middle of the funnel or even bottom of the funnel moments, you know, touch points. So when you're at a trade show, I think it's fine if you're not meeting thousands of people. I think the important thing is that you meet with people that are the right fit and really have interesting conversations, right? And really, and also, you know, I think a lot of times, what we're seeing in some research, I think Freeman put out some research about this, which I think is quite interesting, is that a lot of buyers want to speak to the technical people. Mm. Traditionally, buyers meet salespeople, right? But a lot of times buyers actually want to ask some really hard questions that salespeople don't necessarily have the answers to.
Correct.
You know, and so that changes the dynamic a bit, because it's not top of funnel anymore. If it was top of funnel, the salespeople would be fine. But if you're actually having very in-depth conversations, you need people that understand the product really deeply. And so I think the who's attending trade shows is shifting. And I think the strategy around the exhibitors needs to shift as well so that they can make the most of it.
PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers. Through its presentation and discussion modules, sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive buyer qualified engagement process. PitchLink requires no installation or download, contains and manages the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without interruption. Connect with us on LinkedIn or visit tradeshowengage.com. That is tradeshowengage.com.
Well, Miguel, this has been wonderful, insightful, and thank you for being open and for sharing your thoughts.
Well, pleasure being here.
But no, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes featuring great conversations on engaging your booth visitors and maximizing your ROI from your trade show investments. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being with us today on the Trade Show Podcast, the podcast of record for the trade show and events industry. Here we talk to movers and shakers of the $50 billion trade show industry and identify ideas, challenges, tactics, and strategies to leverage the first-party intent inherent in the trade show business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and implement some of the ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of the Trade Show Podcast. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platform like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This is a BizCast original podcast and is produced for PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.